You are listening to WCOM 103.5 LPFM, Chapel Hill and Carrboro, North Carolina.
This is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom show, The Wake Up Call. I'm Dick Paddock, co-host, and Emily and Lori are not available this week, so we're playing a recent address by Rani Amasri, a local activist, and a Palestinian who lives in the Triangle, to members of Balance and Accuracy in Journalism on August 19th. We feel like it's a very important thing that needs to be spread throughout our neighborhood as much as we can. Her talk is entitled, From Ferguson to Palestine.
Home and to see so many friends and familiar faces. Actually, I'm not sure it's great to see so many familiar faces. Maybe it's good to see a few strangers in the crowd. But so this is what I want to talk to you about, which is how we can learn from the example in South Africa, how we can apply those tactics to what's happening right now in Israel-Palestine. And I specifically use Israel-Palestine without denoting what exactly is Palestine and what exactly is Israel. I'm not one for names. I'm more one for looking at policy. So let's first understand what we mean by apartheid. Typically, that term gets tossed around and it has a lot of emotional appeal, and people either emotionally accept it or emotionally reject it. But this actually is a very clear term with a very, very clear definition. So this is the way that the UN General Assembly decided apartheid should be defined back in 1973. And this emphasis is my own. What's in red and italics is my own emphasis. But specifically what I want you to notice is we're talking about the domination of one racial group over another, and specifically this domination would take the form of segregation, so anything that's separate, which we here in the South still have great, not great, but we know what it means. Expropriation of land, which is a very gentle way of saying theft of land, and denial of the right to leave or the right to return to their country, and denial of the right to nationality, and denial of the right to freedom of movement and residence. So they're very clear definitions. So if we have any country or any government that actually has laws or has policies or practices that impose these definitions, then it's apartheid. It's just that simple. South Africa is simply being used in this definition as an example. It's not being used that it has to be in South Africa or that it has to involve all the history of the indigenous South African population. No, it's just an example. So let's take it a step further. Who says Israel enforces apartheid? Well, for one, the former education minister of Israel says this, and she says, through its army, the government of Israel practices a brutal form of apartheid in the territory it occupies. And she goes further and states, we do not limit ourselves to denying the Palestinian people human rights. We not only rob them of their freedom, land, and water, we apply collective punishment to millions of people and even, in revenge-driven frenzy, destroy the electricity supply for 1.5 million civilians. Let them sit in the darkness and starve. And here she's specifically referring to Gaza. And one thing that I want to point out to you is, quite unfortunately, it's only bombs that bring a situation to the media. And so long as a community is not being bombed, the media tends to ignore this. We saw this very clearly in Iraq. In numerous conversations that we had with national media outlets, they told us, sanctions is not news, it's only bombing that's news. But sanctions is a lot more destructive to a community than bombing. The same thing applies in Gaza. Gaza has been under a very strict blockade for years now. So all the destruction that was imposed a few years ago, none of that has been allowed to be rebuilt. None of that. And what is banned is ludicrous. I mean, sometimes toilet paper gets banned. Sometimes pencils. It is so reminiscent of Iraq that I can't help but think this is a government that has learned very well from the United States, quite unfortunately. But is it only the Israeli education minister? Here we have this quote. We enthusiastically choose to become a colonial society, ignoring international treaties, expropriating lands, transferring settlers from Israel to the occupied territories, engaging in theft, and finding justifications for all these activities. Okay. And who's saying this? The Israeli Attorney General. Former Israeli Attorney General, who also went on record as saying, we establish an apartheid regime in the occupied territories. So very clear statements made by people who in no way can be defined as being, quote, anti-Semitic, which is the common rejection that we have whenever we try to criticize the Israeli government. We get, you know, the attack that we're being anti-Semitic. But who else has been saying that Israel enforces apartheid? Just a few names. Just a few. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, former U.N. Special Rapporteur for Human Rights, the United Nations General Assembly President, the Human Sciences Research Council of South Africa very recently released a report in which they studied the situation in the occupied territories, and they said this is apartheid. Also, the former South African Prime Minister himself, who was the architect of apartheid in South Africa, said, and I quote, "Israel, like South Africa, is an apartheid state." In the past few years, we've also seen noted journalists, including Naomi Klein, who's gone on record as saying, we're dealing with apartheid in Israel, we need to deal with it the same way we dealt with it in South Africa. And there's so many more quotes that I can give you, so if you're interested in more quotes from more leaders, just let me know. But we need to recognize that what's happening in Israel / Palestine is more than simply what's happening in the occupied Palestinian territories. There's three forms of oppression here. One, which is the most popularized form, is the prolonged occupation and colonization of Gaza and the West Bank, which includes East Jerusalem and the other Arab territories. When we refer to the other Arab territories here, we're specifically referring to the Golan Heights, which again gets dismissed a lot. But much of what is imposed in the West Bank is also imposed in the Golan Heights. Okay? Unfortunately, we don't pay that much attention. Much of the wine, by the way, if you see Israeli wine, that's typically Israeli wine from the Golan Heights. Not Israeli wine from 1948 Israel. Okay, so when we look at this, let's pay this some attention. What exactly is happening in the occupied territories? Are things getting better? Unfortunately, and I'm just going to present to you the latest news, and what I mean the latest news is just what's happened in the territories in the past few weeks. As to the fresh news, what has the Israeli government done in response to President Obama? Has he really given any shift in the Israeli policy? Has he really been this man of hope? He was referred to in the Middle East when he first came to presidency as, this is the new John F. Kennedy. Within 2 days, the newspapers all changed their perspective on him. This is 18th of August. 18th of August, we're talking about yesterday. The Guardian writes about land theft and expulsions that are continuing in East Jerusalem. And here, what's happening is we're dealing with two families, which therefore includes around 53 people, who were given legal, and this is what's important to note, is this isn't illegal theft, it's not illegal home demolitions. These are legal. These are approved of by the Israeli courts. So when we talk about legality, we need to understand whose laws are we talking about. International law says no. Israeli law says no problem. Okay? So this is legal according to Israel. They removed these Palestinian families from their homes. Immediately, Jewish settlers got into these homes. Okay, and again, this was given by the courts, which said that these families have no right to live there, even though one family specifically has been there for 53 years and another family has been there for 50 years. So what this family did is they immediately had a press conference. Let's see. There we go. And this was one sign that they put on their press conference. And just to point out, this was their main sign, which they're appealing to Obama. And they're saying, Obama, yes, you can stop housing evictions in Sheikh Jarrah, which is the neighborhood in East Jerusalem. Now, these families that have been thrown out of their homes are living in tents right beside their homes. And this, again, just happened 2 days ago. But it's not just that. And this is what we need to understand, that what's happening with these expropriations and these thefts and these home expulsions is a regular, almost daily occurrence in the West Bank. It just so happened that this specific event reached the Guardian. I don't think it reached any U.S. paper, but it reached the Guardian. It reached Haaretz, by the way, which is much better than any American paper to read, other than if you're reading, you know, a socialist paper. There's my political leanings already disclosed. This was also published in the Guardian, and here what this writer is talking about is how the Israelis actually view the wall, which the Israeli government refers to as a security fence, and which the Palestinian NGOs refer to as an apartheid wall, and which the international courts refer to as illegal. So call it what you will, international law states very clearly that this wall is illegal. This wall does not go over the 1967 lines. It actually covers the water lines. And so it's designed to take more of the Palestinian water and present it to Jewish settlers and actually to divide villages amongst themselves. And in certain instances, they divide homes amongst themselves. And here what he's talking about is, if you can imagine this wall, and this is just one aspect of the wall, and I present this picture so you can get an idea of the height of the wall that we're talking about. On one side of the wall, the Israelis paint nature, grass, trees, a beautiful image. So what in essence they're saying is that there's nobody on the other side. We're not seeing the other. The other becomes completely ignored, completely non-existent, which is, in a way, the spiritual and philosophical way of committing ethnic cleansing. We don't see you. You don't exist. So, of course, you don't have any rights because I don't see you. So that's a philosophical way of looking at it, but then there is the legal way. And this is what Jerry was referring to. Again, this is very recent, where now we have the same prison atmosphere that the Israeli government has been imposing on Gaza that they're imposing on the West Bank. And they're imposing this for several reasons. What they're basically saying now is, if you go into Israel via Jordan, then you're only allowed to go into the West Bank and East Jerusalem at most. You are not allowed to go into 1948 Israel. You're not allowed to go into Yaffa, Haifa, Tel Aviv, West Jerusalem. No, we're going to block that out for you. If you have an American citizenship, a European citizenship, if you're a humanitarian aid worker, if you're a Palestinian, we're going to try to limit your movement as much as possible. And if you come in via the Tel Aviv airport, we're not going to let you cross to the other side. And this particularly applies to non-Jews. If you're Jewish and you really want to go, the law is different. But it's particularly designed to divide, to make it very difficult for humanitarian aid to go through, and to limit as much as possible movement in any way, shape, or form to limit it. And so here what we see, this was a visa stamp on an Italian passport. So Palestinian Authority only, they're only supposed to go into specific areas within the West Bank. So we see, again, a duplication of the prison atmosphere in Gaza. But we can talk a lot about the occupied Palestinian territories, and I'm not interested in focusing there, because most of you, I'm sure, are relatively aware, if not fully aware, of the horrific situation there. And typically, when people talk apartheid, this is what they think about: the West Bank, Gaza. But that's only one aspect of it. Only one aspect. There's two other aspects of it. The second aspect is the racial discrimination against Palestinian citizens of Israel. Okay? What aspects of discrimination are there, both legally and through policy, that are being imposed since 1948, more prominently since 1952, against Palestinians who managed to remain in one way or another in what became the State of Israel, but who happened not to be Jewish? What kind of laws are in place to make their lives very, very difficult? And we see there's a few aspects here. The most dominant, the foundation of these laws of discrimination, are these three. The 1950 law of return, which is very, very different from the right of return. The right of return is the internationally recognized right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes. The law of return is an Israeli law that states that any Jew anywhere in the world has automatic Israeli citizenship. And therefore, nationality is defined by religion, and there becomes a separation between nationality and citizenship, which in many ways you would think this is odd. I'm a citizen of the United States, my nationality is just American, it's very simple. But if I were Palestinian with an Israeli citizenship, I would be a citizen of Israel, but my nationality would not be Israeli, because I'm not Jewish. And there become very, very different laws that become applied to people holding the same citizenship depending on their specific religion. Okay, that's one aspect. Then we have the 1952 citizenship law, which created a two-tier legal system whereby Jews hold nationality and citizenship while the remaining indigenous Palestinian citizens hold only citizenship. So therefore, we have two levels of this law. Now again, in the United States, if you're a citizen, you have full rights. With the exception that, you know, I can't be president. I doubt I could win any seat in the legislature, but okay, since I'm not born here, I can't be president. That's the only difference. Other than that, we're all equal as Americans. In Israel, no. It's very codified in the law. And still, there's the Israeli status law of 1958 that takes it a step further. And this is a law that authorizes the World Zionist Organization / Jewish Agency and all its subsidiaries, including the Jewish National Fund, and this is a very key organization, to control most of the land in Israel for the exclusive benefit of Jews. And they're very clear about this. And I'll talk more about this with the recent law that Benjamin Netanyahu is seeking to impose. Okay? Very clear that public lands are only for the exclusive benefit of Jews. Jews from any citizenship, but only Jews. Okay, regardless if you happen to have papers. So what does this mean? Basically, what does this mean? It means that we find racial discrimination against Palestinian citizens of Israel in literally every aspect of life. Every aspect of life. Land ownership. It depends what your religion is. Even if you have the same citizenship, it impacts whether you're able to own property. Education is very key. And to me, education means a lot to me simply because I'm much more familiar with how our education system here in this area got transformed. I'll give you just one number. This was a report that was published in March of this year, and it revealed that the Israeli government invests $1,100 for every Jewish pupil's education compared to $190 for every Palestinian pupil's education. And this isn't a system where they say, okay, so they're not spending money on the public school system in the Palestinian areas, fine, I'll send my child to, you know, a Jewish-run school. Well, there have been attempts to do that recently. Now, given that if I send my child to a Jewish-run school, that means my child won't learn Arabic. Okay, my child won't learn anything about his own indigenous history. Okay, I'm willing to grant that because I want my child to get an education. But guess what? The school won't accept him because he's not Jewish. Even in kindergarten, the school won't accept him. So it's that pervasive. It also applies to teachers. Even though there's a teaching shortage, the hiring goes to the Jewish teachers and not to the Palestinian citizens of Israel who are non-Jews. That's just one example. There's another example that meant a lot to me as an environmental scientist. A recent report by the government, the Israeli government, that looked at cancer studies, only looked at cancer in Jewish neighborhoods in Israel and did not cover any Arab neighborhoods in Israel. And you go, why did they do that? And then you go, okay, if we don't include their clusters, that means we don't have to worry about this term called environmental justice. So then we can put all our factories in their area. They can have higher cancer incidents. It doesn't matter. We won't even report it because we don't see them and we don't classify what's happening there. So it's pervasive even in the research that's done. Not only the laws, but even the very aspect of research. And recently, and this is clear, these aren't just 1950s laws. This was an article published in Haaretz 3 days ago, 16th of August, published by the co-executive director of an association for the advancement of civic equity in Israel. And he says, material discrimination against Israel's Arab citizens is pervasive and well documented. It manifests itself in almost every sphere of life. Welfare and development budgets, funding for education, land allocation. And then he goes further and talks about this aspect where Israel, technically, you have three official languages. Hebrew, English, and Arabic. And you go, you see the signs, most of the signs are in Hebrew, English, and Arabic. But they only point to Jewish neighborhoods. You find no signs that point to Arab neighborhoods. So there's no directions that go there. And recently there are attempts to even remove the Arabic from the signs. And he was talking about this, that it's reached that level. And again, these are statements being made by Israelis within this area that are saying Israel must be a state based on justice and equality and not on forms of discrimination against Arabs. And it's interesting, by the way, you'll find that Palestinians who carry Israeli citizenships are never referred to as Palestinian Israelis. They're referred to as Arabs, which is, to me, quite offensive. It's a murky way of denying somebody their own identity. And it's very, very problematic. It's like if I were to decide how I want to call Native Americans or American Indians or the First Nation. I call them the way they choose to be called, not the way I find it comfortable to call them. But you'll find this very pervasive. And it's also reached a stage that now there's something called Ghazans, people of Gaza. There is no such thing as people of Gaza. They are Palestinians in Gaza. But they're not their own separate nationality. They're not their own separate identity. And again, be very wary of this, because this is how we start with this kind of separation, this kind of breakdown. We've seen it happen so much. We saw it happen in Iraq. From 1990, there were no longer Iraqis. They were called Sunnis, Shias, and Kurds. So that made it easier in our mind to then allow the separation of a country, because we already denied them their own chosen identity. But digression. Third aspect of oppression, which is one of those aspects that becomes the most difficult to talk about because it's viewed as the hot button. Let's not talk about refugees. Let's not go there. But no, let's go there. We need to go there and talk about refugees and talk about what's actually happening to refugees. Given that, it's very clear now by two Israeli historians, Benny Morris and Ilan Pape. Benny Morris justifies it, Ilan Pape condemns it, but they both state very clearly in their review of Israeli documents that the Palestinians were expelled, the majority of whom were expelled at gunpoint or at fear of gunpoint. So they didn't sell their property. They didn't choose to leave. The vast majority of those that left, left at gunpoint or at fear of gunpoint. The ones that were able to remain, many of whom weren't at their specific village, and so they're referred to as internally displaced. But we had, between 1947 to 1949, approximately 750,000 refugees that were thrown out of their homes with nothing but the clothes on their back. Now the status of the refugees is quite problematic, and you'll find it growing, and the main aspect that people talk about is this demographic problem. But every Palestinian that I know in Lebanon, those that are born and raised there, when you ask them where they're from, they won't say Mukhayyam Ayn al-Halwi, the Ayn al-Halwi refugee camp, or the Nahr al-Bayrid refugee camp. They won't even say Palestine. They'll say their specific village. I'm from Lid, I'm from Yaffa. And they'll tell you, well, they've never been there, they've never seen it, but their grandparents came there, their grandfather came there, their father came there. They have these memories, and everyone has a key, because that's all they left with, just that key. Now, international law is very, very clear that the refugees and their descendants, it is international law that stipulates they have the right to return and the right for reparations and compensations, not an either or. They have, and it's an individual right. So when you notice so-called Palestinian leadership, okay, very few Palestinian leaders, unfortunately, I think that we're cursed with our leaders, both in the States and in the Middle East. But you have them discussing this aspect of relinquishing the right of return. It's not a right that can be relinquished by any leader. It is an individual right. Individual right. So it doesn't matter what treaty Palestinian leaders or Arab leaders choose to sign. It's an individual right that cannot be taken away. The only reason they are not allowed to go back is not because there's no space, which then we say, okay, if there's no space, what are we going to do? It's solely because they're not Jewish. That's the only reason. Okay, and it happens to be a religion you can't really convert to, so it makes it a bit difficult. Because the running joke in my community is, okay, we'll just be Jews. That's the problem. Yeah. So we have this issue that's happening, and given very recently, this was just last week. Just last week, now Benjamin Netanyahu wants to do something called the privatization. He wants to impose a privatization of land. So now if we go back and remember, okay, 1947 to 1949, by the expulsion of the majority of the indigenous population, all their lands, all their properties were then seized by the government and were regarded as governmental property. That then the government allows others to lease or the government places under green spaces. So you find Israel has a lot of green spaces, all of which are temporary. Okay? Now Benjamin Netanyahu is saying, you know what, let's privatize these lands. Privatize these lands means let's open them up for sale. So then our first thought would be, great, we'll raise up a fund and, you know, buy this property and give it back to the people who were expelled from it. Okay. Except there's a caveat. It can only be sold to Jews. So then we find, okay, this one is a violation of international law. It's a violation of United Nations General Assembly resolutions. And it's a violation of basic codes of ethic, I would say. Basic codes of ethic. And this is what they're working on right now. Now, that sign, of course, is not in Israel. That sign is somewhere in the south. I don't know exactly where the circumstance was very similar. Black individuals wanted to move into a neighborhood. That was a sign that was replaced there. So then we looked at all that and we asked ourselves, so what are we going to do about it? And we can do a number of things. We can say, the situation is way too big. It's way too huge. I can't do anything. Which is a feeling that I get a lot, and I'm sure it's a feeling that crosses our minds a lot. Or we can say, what is the similar to, and how can I learn from what else has happened, and how can I try to understand what other lessons have happened? So if we look at this, what worked in apartheid South Africa? It's a very, very similar circumstance. What worked there? successful there. And we find that in analysis after analysis, it wasn't a public transformation out of the blue. It wasn't that the apartheid regime just got a change in conscience. Okay? And it wasn't that internally they did it on their own. It was a global solidarity movement with the local community in South Africa, working together. And what they did was a boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. They worked on all three. So what is boycott, divestment, and sanctions? Boycott is basically a form of pressure through non-cooperation. It's all basic, and I'll talk about this in more detail later on. Divestment is when your organization, your institution, your university invest in some corporation, you want them to get them not to invest in that corporation. And sanctions, of course, we're familiar with sanctions, they're more governmental imposed. So this, the sanctions, becomes something very difficult that I think we can impose. The other two are more achievable. The essence of BDS, okay, is we're talking about applying pressure to change policy. The difference between this and terrorism, both of which are designed to apply pressure to change policy, is that one is nonviolent and one is violent. Terrorism is defined in the United States as coercion of a civilian population to change governmental policy. Okay? Coercion and using violent tactics. Here, there's no violent tactics. It's a nonviolent movement to change governmental policy, to include corporate engagement. And the essence of BDS, and this is what was successful in South Africa, the essence of it isn't economic destruction. Because the movement will always be too small to cause a real shift in the strength of the economy. The essence of BDS, the victory of it, stems from the idea of shaming the other. It's shaming them, it's isolating them, it's making them feel internally that now they don't feel comfortable identifying themselves as coming from that community. Which I heard from a lot of Americans that when we travel, we identify ourselves as Canadians. So in a way, it's a more organized impact to cause that. Okay. So what are some lessons that we can take from the South African example? And these aren't listed in any order of priority, by the way. But one is sustainability. And I know in my generation, there's a feeling that I have that it was maybe a 5 to 10 year movement, and there was this big shift, and all of a sudden, you know, the apartheid movement, the global boycott, divestment movement was so strong, apartheid fell. And it just happened overnight, and everybody was in support of it. Not at all. We are talking about a movement that began in 1959. And it took until 1963, it took 4 years, before there was even one victory. 4 years before there was even one victory. And this was at a time when Nelson Mandela was defined as a terrorist. This was at a time when corporations were very proud to do business with apartheid South Africa. It was a long struggle. It was not a quick struggle. It was a struggle that a lot of people said cannot be won. But it was through sustainability, which is when we translate it for us, when we look at the BDS movement that's applying itself to Palestine, Israel, we notice that it erupts when there is a bombing and it goes to sleep afterwards. And we see that happen throughout. Gaza gets bombed, everybody boycotts, and then it gets off the news and we forget about it and we go to our next cause. And it's critical when we work on this, and I would say it's critical when we work on any cause, that we measure our energy and we do it sustainably, because this is a long run. Now, relatively speaking, I think it's a short-term victory. And I mean short-term, that I think we can win this in 30 years at most. Okay, which, in my relativity, I would say it's very short-term. Long-term, I would be thinking is, you know, my grandchildren will get to experience it. That would be a long-term. That's the timeline I'm thinking about. So it is sustainable. The second thing is, there needs to be meticulous research. The companies that we talk about, the companies that we seek to highlight, are not generally companies that, you know, declare themselves as being invested in Israel in one way or another. It's some research that we have to do. And they did a lot of research in apartheid South Africa, a lot of uncovering of information, a lot of meticulous approach. And then there's the linking of struggles. The linking of struggles is critical. And this is what we really mean by solidarity. And again, this is what one of the main anti-apartheid activists said. And I quote him when he says, "The healthy linking of struggles against racism in support of the indigenous people and workers in North America with the Palestinian struggle that he has witnessed must be applauded." So it means that not only when we go to the streets and say, okay, we are calling for an end of occupation for Gaza, we can't simultaneously be ignoring a local workers' movement, which means that those of us who are supporting right of return or end of occupation would be working in North Carolina at the same time to support health care reform. They go hand in hand. We'd be working simultaneously to support union strength, because it goes hand in hand. Those of us who are supporting right of return or end of occupation would be working in North Carolina at the same time to support health care reform. They go hand in hand. We'd be working simultaneously to support union strength, because it goes hand in hand. And it was the same thing that they were doing in South Africa. That's what gave them the sustainability, because they were linking their struggles and recognizing that these struggles are all one. They're all one. So that becomes really, really critical. Fourth, support of indigenous organizations. And here again, he goes back and talks about their experience in South Africa, what worked and what didn't work. And what worked was when external movements actually listened to the call from South Africa and worked with them and supported them, which means that for us, we listen to Palestinian organizations, both in the occupied territories, both in Israel and in the diaspora, and see how we can be working together and not be working in isolation. Which for some, none of us here in North Carolina, but I used to work a lot with New York organizations, and the idea of working with anyone else was extremely difficult. So it becomes critical. And then, well, actually, one more thing to add about this, the support of Palestinian grassroots organizations. When we talk about boycott, one of the issues that they're suffering from a lot right now in the occupied territories is this issue that nobody's buying Palestinian goods. So even within the area, it's really hard to find Palestinian goods, and it's really hard to purchase them for a number of reasons. So that means when we do boycott, we also should do boycott. So it's not only that I'm not going to buy this product, but then I'm going to go find Palestinian olive oil and make sure it's Palestinian olive oil, okay, and seek those products. It also means, and this is what we found to apply in Lebanon, I'm sure it applies here, most of these companies that we want to boycott, regardless of what they're doing in Israel-Palestine, we want to boycott anyway. I mean, Starbucks is known for its influence in Israel-Palestine. But give me a break. Starbucks is anti-union. They employ prison labor. They're anti-environment. What they do in Ethiopia is reason enough to boycott them. What they do in Indonesia against the Tigers is reason enough to boycott them. And what they do to mom-and-pop coffee stores is reason enough to boycott them. You bring that all together. My God, boycotting this organization would actually be good for our community, let alone as being good for the community we seek to have solidarity with. And we find this applies to numerous other companies that we want to highlight, where we're talking about boycott and boycott and bring them together. And then lastly, the key is isolation, which means that the key is not simply economic boycott. What worked in South Africa was not only the economic boycott. Actually, if it were just economic boycott, it would not have worked. And we've read a lot of analyses from medical departments and academics and research organizations in South Africa that said actually the boycott was good for us economically. It made us do our own research. Just like the economic boycott against Cuba has been brilliant for organic agriculture. The best organic agriculture in the world is in Cuba. So in that way, it was great. Okay, you know, on one aspect. What worked in South Africa was that this economic boycott was coupled with a cultural, diplomatic, and academic boycott. It was coupled with that, and that is what made it succeed. It wasn't just the economic boycott alone. And this is where we have a bit of discomfort. Why do I want to academically boycott anyone? Why do I want to culturally boycott anyone? Why do I want to boycott just a tennis game? Why don't I want to have an Israeli sports team come and play tennis? It's something great. It'll be an exchange of ideas. In this aspect, I'm sorry to sound like the Godfather, but it's not personal. The aspect of this is to get the community to say, look, I'm really not liked because of my government. I need to work at home to change my government. It basically is that simple. And the idea of cultural boycott is also so important because the Israeli government has stated time and time again that the cultural importance of Israel is what gives Israel its credibility and its legitimacy. It's something that the Israeli government works on, they push for. They've even paid people to go on Twitter. They've paid people to go on Facebook to simply promote the goodness of Israel. This is a governmental action, which means they see that as hand-in-hand with other kinds of propaganda. So that means that we see it as hand-in-hand with other kinds of propaganda. Okay. So then what does this mean for our actions? Where do we take all this information? Where do we put it? Going back to here, okay, we've got several different kinds of boycott. Of course, the product boycott, which I'll talk about soon, how we identify which companies we want to boycott, what that means. The academic boycott, which I'll also talk about soon, which is gaining a lot of leverage around the world, which basically means that, example, myself as an educator, I was asked recently to go to a workshop organized by the European Union where they wanted to get professors and scientists together to talk about Mediterranean environmental security. Great. It's perfectly up my alley. Since it's a workshop, that means we're going to be collaborating on recommendations. So I asked them very clearly, is there anyone from Israel who will be there? Not is there anyone Israeli, is there anyone from Israel representing an Israeli institution? Because if there is, I can't go. Because I can't collaborate with them on this project. That's what we mean by an academic boycott. It means that if there's a grant, I'm not going to apply to the grant with someone from an Israeli institution. Not someone who's Israeli in the US, but somebody working from Tel Aviv University or Hebrew University. No, I can't do a joint grant with you. That's what it means. It doesn't mean I'm not going to publish in a magazine that there is somebody on the board who's Israeli. That's not what it means. That's what we mean by an academic boycott. Cultural boycott, which we'll talk about recently, means if we have any singer, Madonna wants to sing in Israel. No, don't go sing in Israel. That's what it means. We're not going to be encouraging singers to go to Israel and to be doing performances and to be regarding it as if they're going to France or as if they're going to Nigeria. No, it's not the same. That's what we mean by cultural boycott. Sports boycott is, again, teams, we don't want them to be playing together. That's what we're talking about, this level of isolation. And again, it's a non-violent form of protest that has proved to be effective. Divestment, we're talking about institutional investors. Churches, universities, other organizations, do not divest in these corporations. Do not invest in these corporations, invest in others. Sanctions I'm not highlighting because it's not even an option for us to get governments to actually do restrictions unless you happen to live in Venezuela, in Bolivia, or in Mauritania that actually impose sanctions. But if you live in Venezuela, this whole talk would be different. Yeah. So which companies do we boycott? And this is by a lot of research that was conducted by Lebanese Americans in Lebanon. And so one is companies that invest in Israel or the occupied Palestinian territories. Either one. Okay. So we're talking about PepsiCo, which invested recently, they purchased 51% of an Israeli company. So we boycott PepsiCo, which for health reasons, we should boycott PepsiCo anyway. So it's not a problem, okay? Companies that invest in Israeli firms, that means there's an Israeli firm that they're investing in, they're supporting. Again, we highlight them. So companies that invest in Israeli firms, let me give you some example of those. Caterpillar goes further than investing in Israeli firms. Caterpillar actually custom makes bulldozers specific to the Israeli government so that only for the purpose of home demolition. So it's something that nobody can say, really, I want to invest in this organization. And again, as an American, read the Grapes of Wrath. There was reason enough in the Grapes of Wrath to boycott Caterpillar anyway. With U.S. tax dollars, yes. Companies that make gifts to Zionist organizations. Okay, now notice here we're saying, okay, but my God, it's charity. Why should we be opposed to companies that give money to charities? The idea is the Jewish National Fund is considered a charity. Okay, the Jewish National Fund is an organization that specifically enforces the idea of property that is Palestinian to be given exclusively to Jews. So we've got a problem with that organization. Coca-Cola's corporate offices in Atlanta donate regularly to the Jewish National Fund. So does Estee Lauder's CEO. Estee Lauder's CEO not only is the president of the Jewish National Fund, not only is he personally the largest investor in Jewish-only homes in occupied territories, he also runs summer camps to promote Zionism among European Jewish children, and he's gone ahead and bought some really good companies. So emotionally, you should be opposed to this fellow, as well as they continue to test on animals on their cosmetics. So there's so many reasons. Estee Lauder has purchased Clinique and Origin and Bobbi Brown and MAC. I think that's it. There might be another one. So a lot of cosmetic companies. Okay? McDonald's gives to the United Jewish Federation. Again, we shouldn't be eating at McDonald's. Nestle, the companies that have run out of reasons. I mean, what is it going to be? Their support of baby milk formula that caused an increase in infant mortality in Northern Africa? Or is it again going to be their terrible environmental record, their anti-union behavior, their promotion of really unhealthy foods? Or is it going to be that they donate food and money and training specifically to Israeli organizations? And recently, they actually set up a cereal company in the occupied territories specifically. So again, there's so many reasons. And I've yet to pick up on a company that I don't like. Philip Morris, on and on. Companies that invest in Israeli firms, again, we've got the same listing. In addition to Starbucks. Starbucks bought an Israeli company that sells coffee. They bought a coffee company called Shalom Coffee. And then, incidentally, a few years ago, they sold it. Now, they say that they sold it because economically it wasn't profitable. So I'm not sure if we can claim credit for that. But I say, you know, why not? I'll claim credit for them selling that. Though, I'm still encouraging people to boycott Starbucks. So regardless what they do in Israel-Palestine, please don't drink coffee at Starbucks. Okay. Companies that open research centers, it's a misspelling, that open research centers in Israel. And the aspect of this is, well, what's the problem with opening a research center? Again, the idea is that it promotes specific technology-based, military-based, and it encourages the economy. Coca-Cola, Estee Lauder, Johnson & Johnson, Nestle, I can give you a much longer list, but these are just some samples. So you can choose, well, which one do we want to highlight? But these are ways that we identify the companies. It's not simply a company that has a store in the occupied Palestinian territory. Burger King, for example, has one. Again, who wants to eat a Burger King? Supporters of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. These are recent, and I'm saying that these are the ones just this year. Just this year, these organizations said, we support boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Canadian Union of Public Employees, Ontario's University Workers Coordinating Committee, that specific committee. I'm not going to say this in French, but a union in Quebec, in the College Federation there, the Scottish Trade Union Congress, which their statement was huge, very powerful, an Australian Dog Workers Union, very recently, and I mean just 2 days ago, the Fire Brigades Union, which is a British firefighter union, also called for the complete boycott of Israel. Academics from England, Scotland, France, Lebanon, and for the first time, the United States. There is a U.S. campaign for academic and cultural boycott of Israel. That's their website. Very recent. So new that the Haaretz said, wait a second. We're used to European academics being opposed to us, but my God, when U.S. academics make this kind of statement, now we have to get worried. So U.S. academics, and this was all in response to Gaza. But it doesn't stop there. Very recently, academics in Israel published a statement in The Guardian saying, boycott us. Academics in Israel, they said, we as Israeli citizens raise our voices to call on EU leaders. They kind of gave up on U.S. leaders, I guess. Use sanctions against Israel's brutal policies. Join the active protest of Bolivia and Venezuela, both of whom cut off relations with Israel during that time. We appeal to the citizens of Europe. Please attend to the Palestinian Human Rights Organization's call, supported by more than 540 Israeli citizens. This is a hugely important statement, saying that a community saying, boycott us, isolate us, please. They actually said, this is the only road left. Help us all, please. To me, this was one of the most moving statements that I read. This was issued earlier this year, again, in response to the Gaza massacre. But when we have people themselves, just like people in South Africa, one of the comments I heard when I was reviewing the history of apartheid South Africa was people were saying, you know, apartheid, the boycott divestment movement against South Africa really hurt the South African population that we wanted to have solidarity with. And the response was, well, they wanted it. They said boycott us. Not only that, you know, it didn't actually hurt them because they were being hurt by other much more punitive aspects. But here, Israeli citizens themselves are saying this. This isn't a majority, but it's possibly a growing sentiment. Possibly. Now, we can look at this and say, how about it's all talk? And it doesn't mean anything until we see really fast economic shifts. What has actually happened really economically? And again, this is all recent. This is all this year. Massachusetts, Hampshire College, set a historic precedent by announcing its divestment from six companies profiting from the Israeli occupation. They were also the first college to divest from apartheid South Africa. So it means a lot from that aspect. In Wales, The Cardiff University acceded to demands by students and decided to divest from companies supporting the occupation. And this has a lot of historic appeal, in South Africa, dock workers refused to offload a ship full of products from Israel. Given that the first victory the BDS movement in apartheid South Africa got was support from dock workers, this just has a lot of historical appeal. That we saw this happening in South Africa, they refused to, you know, to offload a ship. And again, to me, what really moves me most about this, more than what happened in Wales and Massachusetts, was its workers getting together with workers in other communities saying, we are not going to support your oppression. We're not going to do it. Now, possibly, if the workers of the world had, I don't mean to quite sound so Marxist, but if union leaders were more powerful during the BDS movement against apartheid South Africa, possibly we wouldn't have economic apartheid in South Africa, which is what we have now. Possibly we could have destroyed all the aspects of apartheid, not just political. So I would emphasize that these have to be linked, and we need to be working with unions when that's possible. But it doesn't stop there. This is huge. This is really, really huge. The French company Viola withdrew from operating the rail project to connect the city center of Jerusalem with settlements in the West Bank. And this was completely because of the BDS movement. This was a success from Swiss organizations. And observers said, you know, the Swiss did it with such attention to detail and such meticulous sustainability that they managed to get an organization to lose significant amounts of money in Israel rather than lose more significant amounts of money in Europe. Which was how they did it. Either you stop doing this there, or we're going to divest from you. Either you stop doing this there, or we're going to break off contracts with you in Switzerland and in other parts of Europe. And it worked. It was very successful. And again, these are all examples from this year. More. Motorola. Motorola has a specific department in Israel that works on bomb fuses. And these bomb fuses were very important in the latest Gaza carnage. So there became a massive movement, primarily in New York City, combined with international movements, but primarily in New York City, geared to get Motorola to stop doing that kind of production, and recently it worked. They decided we're no longer going to be providing the Israeli government with these products. So we see these real success stories, not small stories, not this aspect that we got a resolution passed, which is no small thing, but this is on-the-ground difference. And it's more. This is a statement published by an economist in March of this year, where he did a review of economic papers in Israel. And you know, businessmen ultimately care about the bottom line. And they found that in 1 month, four articles in economic magazines in Israel were saying, look, there's been an increasing European boycott of our products. We don't like it. We're finding more people are asking us to state what our position is with regards to Gaza before they do business with us. We don't like it. We don't want our government to be doing this policy because it's harming us economically, which is exactly what we want them to say. And to find four articles in 1 month in magazines in Israel is really powerful. The catch that he was saying was the momentum has to be maintained and strengthened. If the momentum is maintained and strengthened, we are going to see a transition in policy. Because there's already been rumblings within the economic circles in Israel saying we're being impacted by this, we don't like this. So we see there's a real possibility for victory here. It's not simply small. And 2 days ago, and this really meant a lot, this is what we talk about, the cultural boycott. Leonard Cohen, I don't know how many of you know Leonard Cohen, Canadian singer, really, really cool singer. He decided recently that he wanted to sing in Ramallah and I believe in Tel Aviv. A lot of protests were geared against him, saying, no, we don't want you singing there. He decided to cancel Ramallah particularly because every single Palestinian organization said, no, we're not going to host you if you're also going to sing there. No, we don't want this. His idea was, we're going to take all the funds from the concert and give it to Israeli and Palestinian organizations. Now, the Palestinian organizations that were named in that fund weren't even contacted. And all the Palestinian organizations that could potentially be contacted said, we don't want money if it's also going to go to the Israeli organizations. No, we don't want that operation. His fund was organized by Amnesty International, which was all the more outrageous. So there became a lot of pressure organized by the BDS campaign on Amnesty International to withdraw its support. 2 days ago, Amnesty International said, we're not going to take care of distribution of the funds because all the funds would be distributed to Israeli organizations. We're not going to do that. We're not going to be involved in this. So this becomes a success in the terms of the cultural boycott. Okay? Now, to get Madonna to change her mind would be more difficult. In London, and this is the fun thing about this. I mean, Emma Goldman said this, that she wanted to dance at the revolution. You know, and the aspect is that if we want things to be sustainable, my God, they have to be fun. Because nobody really wants to do depressing work all the time. It just, our emotions won't allow us. And we find there's some really creative actions that are being done. In London, the organizers go into Tesco supermarkets and they pick up, you know, products that are made in Israel. And they track them in a cart and imprison them. They're not going to release these products until there's a change in Israeli policy. Basically, they put them in a cart and go around and around in the supermarket distributing material, saying why they don't want people to purchase this material and why they're causing this, you know, fun disturbance. There's all these stories of people doing this. I remember an organization in California, Lesbians for Peace and Justice in Israel-Palestine, love these names. They decided to go into Starbucks and declare that by their religion, God has spoken to them that Starbucks is their promised land and they're not leaving. And these are the fun ways of doing this. So this is what's been happening in London. But it doesn't stop there, because arguably you can say that the people who are having the most fun are here in the States. And Ahmad Barghouti writes that there's a lot of diversity to the global BDS movement. He's one of the co-founders of the BDS movement in Palestine. He says, you know, there's a French style, and the French style is they go into chic boutiques in the Champs-Élysées and the mega supermarkets, and they encourage customers to boycott Israeli products. The British occupy university buildings, demanding divestment. The Scots mark Israeli bottled water as containing contamination with apartheid, so don't drink Israeli bottled water because it's contaminated. The Welsh actually catch up Israeli products to drive across a very graphical message. So they throw ketchup on Israeli products. The South Africans don't offload an Israeli ship, thus setting this historical precedent. The Turks, when they recently had to play with an Israeli sports team, actually showered them with shoes, thus following the Iraqi precedent. The Swedes, of course, through meticulous efforts, got to succeed in Viola. And, he says, the Americans boycott Ahava in pink bikinis. This is code pink. And the way that they're protesting Ahava, which, how many people here have heard of Ahava? Okay, it's a cosmetic company that says we're using Dead Sea products from Israel, but it's happened to be from a settlement in the occupied West Bank. Okay, so it's not Israel, it's actually occupied territory, legally. And they distribute this. And so Code Pink says, no, we're not. And they go in there fully dressed and then take off their clothes. They're in these pink bikinis. They put mud all over themselves, and they say, it's stolen beauty. Don't buy a Ahava. It's a product made in occupied Palestine. And the thing is, there's been a victory already. If we notice this woman right here, Kirsten Davis, you know, the conservative woman on Sex and the City, she was taken as the face of Ahava after she was chosen as one of the ambassadors of Oxfam. So there became a lot of protests going, wait a second, Oxfam says, this is occupied territory. So how could Oxfam be claiming that you are an ambassador of Oxfam and you claim to represent an organization that isn't from this occupied territory? Recently, and we highlighted this as saying, Oxfam dumps, you know, Sex and the City, I forgot what her name is on Sex and the City. And so she got dumped again by Oxfam. The idea that Oxfam just last week, very recently, said, no, we're firing her as an ambassador. They said, you know, it's because we don't have any work for her. Of course, no organization, when they do this, say it's because of BDS. But it's because of BDS, and particularly because of Code Pink. Now, Ahava, if you go to Ulta, which is that mega cosmetic store, there's one in Raleigh, I'm sure there's one here, they have Ahava products. So it becomes a really easy thing to do. And I would say, personally, bikinis are optional, and, you know, men, Speedos, whatever, it's a really fun thing. Stolen Beauty, which is the website, you can just go to Stolen Beauty, the Code Pink website on this topic, they've boiled it down. They've given the literature, they've given the exact guidelines. How could you go about doing this if you want to do an event on Ahava? And again, this is something that has already worked. The catch is, as Ali Abu Nama wrote in 2009, the catch is we are at a critical stage. We are really at a critical stage. And I'm not saying this simply because, you know, it's good to say this in a talk, right? A critical stage. far, we find two things are happening. The Israeli government is going for more and more extreme measures, and they're going for more and more extreme measures quite publicly. So in one way, they're no longer trying to appear egalitarian. And so many things that they're doing just these past 2 years, it's much more horrific and much stronger and less covered. And I don't think it's incidental that this is happening at the same time that their claim that we attack Palestinians or Lebanese, for that matter, for self-defense is really losing ground. It's really hard to say that the attack against Gaza really was a self-defense. I mean, hard to measure. Just as it's hard to accept that the attack against Lebanon really was a self-defense, militarily, politically, however way. So there's become this shift. More and more people are rejecting that, and more people are questioning, wait a second, this whole legitimacy of a state only for one group of people based on the domination of that group of people on another is something we have problems with. So we have this fork that's happening, and it all depends who pushes more. If there's more push from the international community, the Israeli government will be moved. I have no question. If there's less of a push from the international community, the Israeli government will continue to move another way. So that's the fork that I think is happening. And this is a fork that's being supported by a lot of analysts. And Ali states it very clearly by saying we must do all we can to push it over. To push it over what limited South African apartheid from being as horrific in their attacks against the indigenous community wasn't that they had a greater sense of conscience. I don't believe politicians, with the exception of, you know, the politicians I love, actually have that sense of conscience. So in that sense, what worked was this global anti-apartheid movement. And just as it worked in South Africa, it very, very well can work here. I've got no doubt. If we follow the lessons and we learn from what happens in the past, this is typically what a lot of people ask for. So I'm just going to stop on this line and say these are some resources. There's so many more resources, including, of course, this is just a good book as a starter. Ben White, its book, Israeli Apartheid, A Beginner's Guide, is really good as a beginner's guide. Start here, progress then to Ilan Pappé, progress to Jonathan Cook's excellent book, Disappearing Palestine. There's so many resources. But the bottom line, and I tell this to my students, the aspect of learning is when we take information and we get it to change our lives. So if we read this material and we say, oh, that's interesting, and it stops there, it's as if we haven't read it. But if we take this material, we take these lessons, we take a little bit of energy that we have and we say, okay, what are we going to do about it? What is something that's within my energetic capability? What's something that the community that I work within is ready to do? Not every community is ready to have a full-out cultural boycott or a full-out academic boycott. Fine. But I believe every community is ready to boycott a house. Every community is ready to divest from Caterpillar. Every community is ready to do something fun in a supermarket. Really. Start there and progress however far you want to go, because every little bit actually makes a difference. The key is that our boycott should not be private. It really, really should be public, and it should be declared, and it should be filled with a sense that, in contrast to a lot of movements that I organized in, I really think this is something we can do. I firmly believe so. So on that, I'm going to open the floor for your questions and comments.
You have just heard an address by Rania Masri, a Palestinian and a resident of Raleigh, to Balance and Accuracy in Journalism. The address was entitled From Ferguson to Palestine. And we hope you enjoyed it. This has been the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom show, The Wake Up Call. See you again next week.
Join Lee Strickland for Focus on Business, Tuesdays at noon here on WCOM.